Episode 35, The Exit Strategy, we speak with Andrew Heintzman of Investico. We ask Andrew about his views of the VC market today, how is he viewing the fundraising side of the market, and review the experiences he's had with his 8 exits within his portfolio. Now, without hesitation, let's hear the count.
1, 2, 3, 4.
You're listening to The Exit Strategy, a podcast that inspires open discussions about financial news and technology today. My name, Marcus Megarian, a recovering SaaS vendor, joined by my co-hosts, Ralph DeFiore and Swadek Mazumdar. And we're sitting down with startup founders, technology experts. Now, let's begin.
You know, you are, for all practical purposes, a North American fund, right?
But correct.
You serve a different geographical area. I mean, from a fund's base point of view, you're a Canadian fund.
We are Canadian. Our funds, we are a management company that has a variety of funds. They're all Canadian LPs, but they invest in Canada and in portfolio companies in Canada and the U.S.
And what kind of mix is it? Are you, give us an idea of the mix, and also what kind of trend are you seeing?
Yes, we're a little more heavily based focused on Canada, just because that's where we're from. We know it. We see kind of a huge percentage of the deals from Canada. So I would say, on average, probably about 60% of our deals are Canadian, and about 40% are in the U.S. Something like that. What we're seeing, it's, you know, you won't surprise you, but the fundraising market is tough for companies right now, and there's relatively a much smaller number of funders like ourselves than there were, well, 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago, and as a result of that, the valuations are generally speaking much lower. And the terms are much more, are generally more in favor of the investor rather than the companies at this moment. Yeah.
Yeah. But in terms of your portfolio allocations, are you using more investments or your dry powder to kind of balance out the existing portfolio companies? Or are you seeing, you know, really startup stuff that's going on there?
Yeah, no, so generally speaking, we describe ourselves as expansion stage. And I would say on average, our companies are between 5 million and 20 million trailing 12-month revenues when we invest. Now, we've done some smaller than that, some bigger, but that's probably 80% fall into that range. And having said that, we're probably leaning a little later stage. So I'd say more and more it would be kind of 10 to 20, 10 to 30 is kind of where we've been leaning as time goes on. And we have done, a little better in that kind of slightly later stage. So that's kind of how we've evolved.
But is that really a trend from your point of view, or it's more strategy looking at the macro and the micro environment?
Yeah, I it's hard for me to say whether that's a trend that other managers are experiencing. I don't know that. What I do know is that, you know, for some reason and I can get into the reasons a bit if you want, but you know, it basically comes down to this: when companies hit 10 million revenues, they're usually pretty well established. Like they often have their kind of everything they need to then grow to like 50 or 100 million, you know. And on the way to 10 million, they often go through transitions that are challenging, you know. So, and those can be transitions in leadership or executive leadership.
Even business model.
Yeah, sometimes even business model. That's right. Sometimes they'll even pivot, like, and you know, those can work out well, but they certainly, in our experience, they add an element of risk to the investment. So what we've found, I mean, again, we're not ruling it out, and I'm sure we'll do investments still below the 10 million mark, but on average, we've found it to be slightly easier going in the kind of 10 million to sort of plus trailing 12-month revenues than in the companies before that.
Yeah, so you know, Marcus is out of Paris. He works purely for European. He looks at the European market, and you know, Ralph, other co-host, is in Miami, warm Miami, may I add. You know, so we all come from different jurisdictions. I mean, we cover different geographical areas. Marcus, are you seeing different kind of trends as well there, based on, you know, just 2023? Is it slowing down, tightening up? Are the Fed watch is still in place? You know, are we showing leadership here? What's going on?
Well, people are definitely looking at things differently this year than they were 2 years ago. You have a lot more people curious about other opportunities or other options. And I mean, I give you plenty of very specific examples of people that weren't considering exiting their company. And then they know that they can't really look towards a European firm to make an acquisition that's going to be some kind of multiple that they would expect. One thing that's very different here is that a lot of the VCs usually take majority positions on these companies. And what you learn from that is that who's really selling? Because the CEO has 12%, or the founding team has 12, 20%, and then the investors have 80% of the stock. It's really what you've done is created a job for yourself, and there's really no incentive. Because if you sell the company, I mean, it's great, but the investor has first rights anyway to get his money back first. And there's a lot of things that I don't think people here read their contracts. And now that they're starting to read their contracts, a lot of them don't want to raise more money. They'd rather exit with a U.S. company because they'll get a higher multiple, or it could be Canadian too, but just North American company. And then they'll really make most of their money from the earnout. You know?
So Andrew, when you look at just on to dovetail into that, when you look at, say, an M&A company that is looking for targets in the North American, you know, ecosystem, would you give them a different multiple, or would you see them with a different set of eyes, or would it be the same?
Say the question again. When you say an M&A company, you mean a...
Yeah. So if you're a portfolio company looking to acquire a company out of Europe, would you look at the structuring differently? Would you look at the multiples differently, or would it be more or less on same lines as a U.S. company?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really. We have never done an investment outside of Canada and the U.S. Now we have starting to think about it a little bit, potentially doing one in Europe. I mean, to be honest, I think it would depend on the growth rates, right? So, I mean, what makes the U.S. Companies have high multiples typically is the size of their market and the potential to expand. So it would depend, I think, you know, where that European company was based and how likely they were to be able to grow. And if they were able to grow at, you know, at the same pace as an American company, then I think I logic would say you'd give them a similar multiple. But the U.S., you know, the U.S. market is just so vast. That's the element that I think gives the American buyers the ability to pay these big multiples, because they can just, you know, they can take a company that might be 50 million in revenues and grow it another 20x and take the cost out. And it's just such a big market, basically. Canada, by the way, generally has lower multiples than American for that very reason, which is our market is just not big enough. And unless the one exception there is Canadian companies that have gotten to be good at exporting into the U.S., then they can achieve a U.S. type multiple. But if they're just staying in the Canadian market, they're not going to get a multiple like they get in the U.S.
Yeah, so I'm thinking, you know, there are some Scandinavian companies in the AI space in particular, or, you know, deep tech space, that are looking at North American, you know, exits. They are getting solid multiples. So
it's worth saying, I mean, I'm in a very specific sector, food, which doesn't, you know, it's an exportable product, but not in the way AI is. So I think technology probably is a very different game in terms of the multiples across geographies. In the food space, it really comes down to just how big is the market you can access. And then you have to get into like transportation and manufacturing and, you know, taking a North American product into Europe or vice versa is a pretty big deal, because, you know, you're either going to incur some pretty significant shipping costs and try to understand a whole new market ecosystem, which very few people are able to do, or else you almost have to build a replica business with manufacturing and distribution and the whole thing. It's pretty rare that people do it until they're like very large companies that they try to do that. So yeah, it probably depends a lot on the specific sector you're talking about.
Right.
I buy things like peanut butter here, like Skippy, and the ingredients are completely different. There's no corn or any kind of soy oil or any of that stuff. So like, if you want to ship things here, it's like, forget about it. There's totally.
I'm guessing, I forget who makes Skippy, but it's probably one of the big food companies, and they probably have like a huge European division manufacturing and just knock off it on in a totally separate manufacturing, you know, and supply chain. So yeah, no, that makes good sense. I mean, once you're a very large multinational company, then you can just produce them separately. Well,
the Skippy is like 2-3 times more expensive here. You don't have hydrogenated oils are illegal. Nitrates are illegal. And there's a bunch of other things that are not allowed. So they simplify a lot of the products tremendously.
Right. You know,
I remember reading a story a long time ago. Heinz, when they introduced ketchup in Japan, was not very successful. And they could understand why. Heinz, you know, if you remember their tagline, good things come to those who wait. Right? So it's very thick ketchup. Japanese like liquidy ketchup. Right. So they never took upon, you know, they never liked the hot, you know, the very thick ketchup till Heinz realized that, you know, it's a different market. It has to be made differently. It's unique to each, you know, geographical. And that's with food, you know, it's very unique.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's true. I think very true, which is the tastes and customs and cultures of each region are so distinct that by and large, they especially the smaller companies tend to stay kind of within one of the geographies, I think.
Ralph, you see a lot of different folks working on transactions just from the position that you are in. Are you seeing also slowdown in, you know, the VC world, VC PE world globally and in the US?
Well, for instance, I was talking to Mary Cantum about the real estate market, and she sees a big slowdown in real estate deals. And in fact, she spoke to an investor, and the investor said, it's got to be pristine now. You know, it's got to be a big name, pristine company, good balance sheet before this investor we commit capital. And I have to say, we haven't slowed down. There's lots of opportunities, but I'm expecting a slowdown to occur, as we've spoken on this podcast. I mean, if you look at commodity prices, they're going down. So it's in the cards. The employment numbers are sending strange messages, but I think that's because they're the shortage of labor. These companies don't want to let go of their employees, and unless they absolutely have to.
Ralph, you've been talking about recession since December, if I recall. You know, you still see it with the new Fed action?
Absolutely. I think what I've been saying is that I thought the Fed was moving way too quickly, not giving enough time to see how their interest rate rises were impacting the economy. So, there's plenty of evidence that we're slowing down. And China hasn't come back like everybody thought.
Yeah, China's really slowing down. Back. Yeah.
Yeah.
China's so, really slowing down. You know, just the VCP PE funding, you know, just in 2023, and I'm talking about global funding. I was reading some reports saying $76 billion just year-over-year decline in the first half of this year. Yeah, that's pretty big. And that includes, by the way, that includes $10 billion that Microsoft invested in OpenAI, and then Stripe, I think there was like $6 billion that went in there. So if you take that out, we're talking about $60 billion. That's not a whole lot. That's like a 60% decline.
Yeah, I saw that too. That was striking. It was quite a significant reduction. So yeah, there's something's afoot. I mean, I guess it's possible this AI kind of feeding frenzy will kick off some more investment, because that does appear to be a new source of exuberance.
Exuberance is right. You know, we had those exuberances in a few other sectors going back in 2020. They are nowhere to be seen today, right? You know, for in all honesty, I'm seeing not just I follow a lot of India investments. AI, EV, you know, deep tech is going gangbusters there, mm-hmm. right? So it's just not the U.S., it's out there as well. And talking to a lot of big funds up there, Matrix and Lightspeed, you know, they all have offices there. They have been investing and chasing after these investments. So that has not slowed down. So exuberance, yeah, to a certain extent, I guess, right? And it's a question of when we feel that bubble will burst.
I also wonder about the, I mean, you guys, this is not a space I know, but the commercial real estate in cities, like I know in Toronto, the occupancy rate for downtown buildings, commercial buildings is really significantly different than it was pre-pandemic, and it doesn't appear to be coming back in the way that some people thought it would. So there's presumably some write-downs to come from that sector. I don't know when or how, but
we see that across the U.S. New York, again, I think it was 15% or 20%, which is pretty significant. And, you know, you have all the Facebooks and the Googles of the world, Amazon of the world, buying huge swaths of land, I mean, office space. But still, you know, there's a lot of occupancy up there. So, yeah, that is a shoe that's ready to drop. That's going to be huge. As a matter of fact, Elon Musk was talking about that last week, mm-hmm. about the commercial real estate slowdown.
Yeah, like our preeminent tech company Spotify has, before the pandemic, took a huge amount of like the top best real estate in Toronto, and it's never used it. It's like floor after floor. I can't even, it's a massive amount of real estate that they've just let sit vacant. And it's literally our creme de la creme, like prime office tower real estate. And that's just one example, but there's quite a lot of that that's happened. And I don't know it. There was also an interesting article about whether some private holders hadn't really written these assets down. So there might be kind of like a whole
write down coming. Yeah.
Write down kind of process coming from some of these guys. Yeah.
No, brings back memories from me visiting China in 2000, I think 15 or 16, when I saw these huge real estates. You know, buildings after buildings after buildings with no one there. They were called ghost towns. And, you know, today China is facing, the response to that, the reaction to that.
Right.
Andrew, how do your companies behave in a recessionary market? Do their customers... look, what you're investing in are premium products.
Yes.
Do the customers of those companies in your portfolio, do they move away from those premium products in a yeah. recession?
Great question. So it's as you can imagine, it's variable. It's but in general, what I would say is the growth rate slows. So people continue to buy and the committed customers continue to be committed, but they have to work harder to win over new customers. And it's more expensive too. So they spending more money to keep that growth rate. And so what, you know, 2022 was a year for our portfolio companies, and this is true, I think, of other sectors too, but of a lot of layoffs. So pretty much what happened was, so let's say 2019, 2020, into the pandemic, everyone had, their capital was easy to get. People were in the food sector, actually did quite well in the early part of the pandemic. I mean, it was one of the sectors that, you know, continued to grow and actually people had more discretionary money because the governments had were actually putting money out, public money. So we actually, our companies did quite well. And they even probably bulked up like in their employees and stuff, like anticipating that growth would continue. And then towards the latter, just at the end, in the last kind of couple of years, and I'd say generally in 2022, it started to slow. And that probably is consistent when interest rates and other things started to come up and inflation and got a little tighter in the market. It got harder to grow. And then the capital dried up. Mm-hmm. And so basically 2022 was a year of, I would say, most of our companies reduced their employees, some quite dramatically. Everyone had to right size because they had to assume basically that they weren't going to raise money for a few more years. So they had to operate on their current cash reserves. So it was a combination of the slowing market and the drying up of new capital. Mm-hmm. We probably had, I would say over 50% of our companies did layoffs in mid to late 2022, and some of them pretty significant ones. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So Andrew, I noticed unless I missed one, I noticed there aren't any cannabis related food items there.
That's true.
But yeah. What's the reason behind that?
Yeah, it's actually a prohibited in our it just the short rules is it's a sector that we've agreed with our investors not to invest in for the time being.
But it's legal in Canada, right? Or
it is legal in Canada. It is legal in Canada. Yeah. Yeah. Right. And you know, that might change, but yeah, it is kind of an irony. I admit to you, there's a few sectors like that, and whether they're ones we I've actually, you know, alcohol would be another one where we've decided not to currently to invest in. Again, we might revisit that, but they generally speaking, even though they're legal, are considered, some of our investors consider them to be not kind of consistent with our objectives. So but you know, as you mentioned, cannabis has been mulled lately, but for a couple of years there, it was like, and if you come to pretty much any city in Canada, but Toronto or anywhere, like every fourth or fifth shop is a cannabis shop now. I mean, they're everywhere.
Really? Wow.
I mean, in fact, there are too many, to be honest. It's why the market got crushed, because it's just like overdone. And in a funny way, the rule might have saved us a little bit of heartache, because you know, the sector rode this crazy wave. And there was a company called Canopy, I don't know if you, it was the one that became the biggest, and they raised $5 billion from one of the US alcohol brands. I forget which one it was. Anyway, it's done that, you know, and it was at its height, it was, you know, a $55 stock. I think today it's probably a dollar or something.
Wow.
So it was a real boom bust. But for a couple of years there, there was a bit of a new gold rush happening in Canada. I think it was to the detriment of the sector in a way, because it got out of hand.
Right.
Yeah, there are tons of cannabis companies out of Canada. And I don't even know whether some of them are going to survive or not. And I do follow them. And, you know, some of them merged, and then now the merge price is even lower, or the consolidated price is even lower than what it used to be. And
yes.
It was a real
boom bust. It was the classic kind of cycle, but accelerated by the huge excitement about, cannabis and, you know, this. I think people kind of took it too far, because this drug that is a drug then all of a sudden got legalized and everyone just jumped on it like it was kind of. And I think people thought that these Canadian companies were, I'm pretty sure that they factored into their valuations the notion that they would use Canada as a jumping point into other markets like the US, which I think some people were banking on the US legalizing cannabis, and then these Canadian companies would then be well positioned to like quickly take up market share in the US. And that never really happened. Like, it's a state by state thing.
That legislation is still on the table.
Yeah.
And it comes up for hearing time and time again, but nothing happens.
Yeah. So I think like some of these big companies at Canopy, a lot of people were betting on that would happen, and they would be then in a position to have, you know, sewn up the U.S. market, but that never, or at least so far, has not come to pass. Yeah.
Andrew, do you try to create some kind of synergy between the companies in your portfolio, particularly on how to handle food and shipping, how to preserve, how to process certain things? Is that something
we're trying? Yeah, we're trying to gingerly, I guess. We're working on a little kind of monthly CEO roundtable that would cover, you know, specific issues that our portfolio companies could call into if they were interested in. So, and you can run the gambit of, you know, as you say, it could be food security, or it could be e-commerce, or it could be, you know, any of the issues that they face. And I'm hoping we get that up and running, because I do think there's more. We do it like informally. We do a lot of putting them together. So if you know, we're on the boards of all these companies, so if they're wondering about something, we'll put them in touch with another CEO. But our goal is to be more, a little more systematic in it. So it's kind of a continuous network that they can tap into.
What do you think is the next big food? Do you see an item out there that people are about to exploit that nobody's thought of before or was difficult?
It's a good question. I mean, some of our best, our greatest hits are kind of like old fashioned things that come back into, like, so we did really well with a company called Vital Farms, which kind of created this new category, which is basically the oldest category there is, called pasture raised eggs, but they're basically chickens that are outdoors. And you know, that whole sector has been kind of commoditized and turned into they have a wonderful ad, by the way, called Bullshit Free Eggs. It's been seen millions of times now. But again, like, this is like the oldest idea in the books, but kind of fell out of favor, and they've built a really significant company. And the other one we have, Maple Hill Creamery, same thing. It's grass-fed organic dairy. So it's kind of like, you know, how we might have farmed, you know, a long time ago, and then kind of that fell out of favor. So you know, it's funny, sometimes our ideas are kind of old ideas, or you also see often like things like old ideas from Europe, for example, like the Greek yogurts or whatever, like those kinds of things, which are or often that kind of ideas that have been around for a long time, and but they kind of get a new head of steam and a new people look at it again. So yeah, I mean, we're kind of, I would say some of the themes that we think are interesting are like our gut health in general, this notion that mm-hmm. our guts are responsible for a lot of the healthiness of our bodies and our minds. And
absolutely.
And we're big believers in clean label products. So like, you know, the shorter the list of ingredients, yet often the better, you know, and that kind of thing. So yeah, our general approach has been a little bit back to basics kind of thing. And I think that there's that, even within that though, there's a lot of room for kind of innovation of looking back to good ideas that used to be available, maybe aren't anymore. Because we all got caught up in, you know, hyper processed, highly manufactured food items, and the world thought that was a great idea for a long time until we realized it wasn't actually very good for people. And then that's kind of turning back.
Like the fat free craze of the 90s.
That's right. That's
and it digested example. In your system like some kind of paste, and it was just disgusting.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
Well, could you, since this is the exit strategy, you guys have done around 8 exits.
Yes.
If you had just for a high level, like what is your experience? Because you've done the whole cycle.
Yeah.
You've raised the fund. You've invested the money. You've gone through the process. You've exited the company.
Yeah. Well, my experience is you got to build, like, really, if you want to exit well, these are kind of obvious rules, but they're worth restating. You have to do is build a great company that people want to buy. And that's the most important part of it. So, and you got to, you know, you got to really nail that. And then if you nail that, then I do think you have to start to plan your exit. So planning your exit means aligning your stakeholders, thinking about it, getting the, you know, the board committees and getting, you know, multiple years of audited statements. And you're basically putting yourself on a foot to have multiple options. So in my experience, you know, the best outcomes happen when you've got lots of options, right? And so, and that includes, if you're, you know, that includes not just having a bunch of buyers, but having a bunch of buyers, but then other options too. So like, for example, Vital Farms was a really interesting one because we actually took it public on the NASDAQ and it worked out quite well. But we, you know, we had an investment bank and we took a long time looking at it and, you know, looked at the options to sell the company, look at the options to IPO, really plan it out. And the company was going from strength to strength on an operating level. So we just, you know, we did it very professionally, I guess you could say. And we hired the right investment banks. And I give credit to the founder and chairman Matt O'Hare and to their management team, the CEO Russell, they did a fabulous job. But again, you know, you need a good operating business, you need a good process, and then you need to create optionality by keeping your options open, and that will then generate the best outcome, I think. And you know, it's one of these things too. I think sometimes it's like, yeah, when you know, it's always easiest to do something when or people. How do I say this? Basically, you're going to get offers when people think you don't need to sell, right? So that's part of the optionality, you know. Because you can also have optionality and timing. If you have to sell in a certain window, you're reducing your chances of it being effective. But if your optionality can include, okay, I could be in any of these, you know, 18 months. We're going to find the right moment, the right time, and we can wait. We can be patient. So it's all about those kinds of planning and preparation, I think.
Do you, because on our presentation of what Chatsworth is, I included a slide that basically states why deals fail. And a lot of the times you said to yourself, like, let me start with things that are very obvious. But the truth is, the obvious is never obvious to the other person. I left finance to work at a UX analytics company. So how customers proceed with their journey on online websites. And it's incredible how you could literally tell with millions of people buying the same product, how they behave online. And the most important thing you learn from that is the fact that most people do not understand what they're trying to buy.
Right.
So when you're trying to sell your company, how many people have actually sold their company? You know, one major difference I have here in Europe versus the United States is that people in Europe are a lot less willing to compromise on the sale of their company than an American group would. You know, so you have a lot more hesitation. You have a lot more time that goes by. You have, it creates deal fatigue. You'd have, you know, you have unrealistic expectations. And one of the most critical things is that whenever you have all these research reports about what valuation should look like, you know, right now it's 5.2 times EV to EBITDA or revenue. And then people are saying, well, that's what I want. I was like, yeah, right. But those statistics are from the United States and Canada.
Yeah. 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 Not, well, I think you're right. People are unrealistic about, I mean, not always, but often unrealistic about what their companies are worth. And they think they're worth the average of what has been sold. But the companies that are sold are exceptional, generally speaking.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's and it's often not a proper comparison.
Well, yeah. I could get very specific about this, especially that you have, like, a lot of the times you'll have many companies. Like, I think 80% of companies or 70% of companies usually get one time or less of their revenue in terms of sale. Yeah. And then 15% will get like the 2 to 4, 5 times. And then that 5%, 3% leftover is basically getting those 20x multiples. But who's the buyer? It's usually a publicly traded bulge bracket, like a Google, a Facebook, or somebody who's willing to give these major multiples. And then what does it take to get there? You have to be the first. You have to be dynamic.
Yeah.
You have to have those great growth rates that you were talking about.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a big
deal. That's true. This idea of an average is, it doesn't, you're right. It's the truth is it's all over the map, and the top brands or companies can command huge valuations, and those that aren't, they're not even in the same ballpark.
Yeah, like I could give you an example of just in France. You have basically, this is for the past few years, the average here is skewed because of one $7 billion exit that happened to the market. And that creates an entirely huge skew where the person says, well, that's the average. It's like, well, there's the one outlier or two outliers that were the unicorn deals of the year.
Exactly. Which
pushes up the valuation. But it's always good to hear from the you know, one of a managing partner of a VC to state their experience of an exit, because it's important, because there's no one way to exit. This isn't buying milk at the store or eggs at the store. It's not a finished product. Every buyer will have a different methodology in how to acquire, or you know, the markets will be different in every circumstance for that kind of IPO.
For sure. And that's one thing we've discovered is, you know, as a VC, you have to be quite open to multiple ways of exit. If you're really focused on one, you're going to struggle. But you really have to be, there are quite a few, including, and we've exited in secondaries to new shareholders. We've exited selling our shares back to the companies in redemptions. We've exited in IPOs. We've been bought out. We've been bought out for shares. We've been bought out for cash, you know, and everything, and merged into our competitors, and, you know, every version of those along the way.
When you say that you sold the shares back to the corporation, is that done through a debt transaction?
I'm trying to think of, so in that case, yeah, what? We've done it a couple of times, but the first time, which was the kind of one I'm thinking of, we, Yeah, they basically they got themselves to a strong financial position, and they borrowed money from a low interest rate from a large commercial bank and bought our equity back.
Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And that was a great, that great, we did well and they did well. And it was a good outcome. Yeah.
Marcus, we are coming to the point where we need to kind of adjourn a podcast. Would love to thank Andrew for his perspective, his thoughts. It's wonderful having that conversation.
Thank you guys. I enjoyed it.
That was episode 35 of The Exit Strategy. Don't forget to like, share, and subscribe. We'll see you at the next episode.